We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host,
this is Keeping
Steve
the Faith,
a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're very happy to have as our guest Tess Hilmo, who is the author of a brand new book called With a Name Like Love. It's a novel for young people. We're talking with Tess by phone. Is this at your home in Utah, Tess?
I am. I'm at home today.
Very good. Well, it's nice to have. We have a good connection, so I'm glad we have you on the line.
And
let me quickly say how much I appreciated this book. I've read it twice already, and it's just out a week ago.
That's great to hear. Thank you for that.
I did get an early copy, I'm happy to say, and I might add that I got that early copy because of my brother Joel Shoemaker in Iowa City, who was writing a review of this book and thought it would be of interest to me and this Keeping the Faith radio show. And after he finished it, sent me a copy, and I've asked Joel to be on the radio with us, too. So they're actually two interviewers for one author, which is maybe a first for NPR.
And I am indeed here from Iowa City today, so glad to be here with you.
Great. And Tess, let's start off with just some background about you. This is your first novel, right?
It is. It's my first novel.
But it's taken you a while to get to this place.
It has. It's been a 9-year journey for me. About 9 years ago, I was put on bed rest with my second child, and I had a lot of time on my hands. I was working full-time, and suddenly I was home, and I started writing, going back to that love I had as a youth, going back to writing, and started writing articles for children's magazines and different stories. And about that time, I decided I wanted to try to write a novel for young readers. And this is the novel that is being published. It's been 9 years.
Now, With a Name Like Love is set in the South, and the short description would be it's about a family, but it's also a Southern murder mystery. Why did you set it in the South?
Well, that's a good question. There are two real inspirations that came together for this novel, and the first one was my love for Southern gospel music. As a little girl, I grew up with a mother who, she was a single mother, and we didn't have a lot, but she would take us camping on the beaches of California. That's where I grew up, or take us out to the deserts in Death Valley. And I remember sitting around the campfire as a little girl and singing "Do Lord" and "This Little Light of Mine," and those are songs that she loved, and she passed that love on to me. And in fact, I have this one memory of being about 6 or 7 years old and walking down the street with a friend of mine, singing "This Little Light of Mine" at the top of my voice. And this friend turned to me and said, "You should not be singing that song. You're just a skinny white girl who can't carry a tune." And it was the first time in my life I had ever been told that I couldn't do something. And I think that's why the memory has stayed with me. But I turned to her and I said, "You're wrong. I won't stop singing these songs." So from a very young age, I loved that Southern gospel music. And as a mother, I wrote songs for my children. I dabbled in music composition. And I ended up writing a song called lead me on. And it's patterned after those Southern Gospel songs. It's in the same pentatonic scale, which is a five-note scale that most classic Southern Gospel music is written in, just five simple notes on the black keys. And so I wrote a song in that same manner, and my mother heard the song, and she knew I had been trying to learn how to write a novel. While this is my first novel being published, I had been writing for several years at this point, learning about the process, and she said, you should write a story to go with that song. And with a name like Love is that story. And my song, Lead Me On, is actually featured in the novel.
Yeah. In the person of a name, a character called Moody, I think. Is that right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. He sings this song. He's an old man who lives up the holler in this little town in Arkansas, and he sings this song. And so I knew that if I was going to incorporate Southern gospel music, it had to be set in the South. Lucky for me, my father's line is from Arkansas, and I had lots of family history and journals and notes and things, and so Arkansas just seemed a natural place to set the story. And in fact, the main character, Ollie, is a family name from my father's side who lived in Arkansas. It was a little bit older than the setting of the book, but still that's where it came from. So that's the Southern setting. And then when I had a Southern setting with gospel music, I don't know, a murder mystery just seemed to fit into it.
Now, Ollie, the main character in the book, is a 13-year-old girl in a family with five daughters. And I noticed in your bio on your very good website, TessHilmo.com, I noticed that you have three daughters now. What I found probably the most fun of anything in the whole book was just how realistically you describe how sisters can get along but also not get along. And I actually have
I have two girls and one boy.
Oh, okay.
Say that.
All right.
But the family was inspired. So the two things that came together for the inspiration for this novel, the first one was primarily this song I had written and my love for Southern gospel music. And then when I started playing with the idea, the second inspiration that came in was my great uncle Will, who was an itinerant preacher back in the 30s, actually. And he had seven children on the road. And his wife kept journals that she printed into a self-published book that my mother gave to me. And I was able to read about the siblings and their lifestyle and the mother, how she raised the children. It was very, very interesting to be able to read about that lifestyle. They were Quakers from Snow Camp, North Carolina. That's my Uncle Will and my family on my mother's side. And he decided, as an adult, he got married and decided to break away from his Quaker roots and just become an itinerant preacher. And he did that.
Now, your story is set in 1957, as I remember.
Yes.
And we just heard on All Things Considered that there's a great interest in the 50s and 60s, particularly on popular television. But how did you pick this time to set this family in Arkansas, this itinerant preacher?
When I originally wrote the book, I wrote it earlier. I wrote it back because I had these records from my mother's side of the family of this itinerant preacher, my great-uncle Will. And so he was back in the 30s and 40s, and I said it then. But the problem I ran into, Steve, was that Ollie's main rub, the issue that she has with her family, is that she wants some luxuries in life. She wants a washing machine, and she wants a hot bath at night, and she just wants to feel like a normal girl going, you know, to a regular schoolhouse. And so I needed to move the story a little bit. I needed to move the story to a date where they had those luxuries, where everyone, it was just common sense that everyone would have a washing machine and everyone would have a refrigerator with an ice maker and those sorts of things. So that's why I ended up moving the story up to 1957, was so that she could have those conveniences that she so desperately wanted, or so that she could long for them.
It turned out to be a fun thing for me as I read the book to review, Tess, because your first sentence says it was the 8th of July, 1957, mm-hmm. which was 54 years, you know, to the day when I was reading The Galley to write the review. So,
interesting.
Yeah, getting to be a an elderly person myself who actually remembers 1957 as a 7-year-old person, it was great fun for me to throw myself back into that time and imagine being in that other place.
My mom had said the same thing. She said, "This is when I grew up. These are my years, and I remember this." And for me, it was trying to find a balance between when they actually had itinerant preachers, you know, because they have died out. For the most part, it's not a common part of the American landscape as much as it used to be, and yet they still had some modern conveniences. So I was just trying to find a balance there.
I knew just enough about that sort of preaching to be able to bring something to my reading of the book, I think, about it, but certainly it was fading at that time, yeah.
Now, Joel is has spent most of his career as a librarian in a middle school in Iowa City, and in addition has written reviews of books for young people, young adults, teenagers. And the review he wrote of your book has appeared in the school library journal. In addition, you've had this novel with a name like Love has been selected by the American Booksellers Association as a New Voices selection for 2011. And Kirkus has said that this is a story about the meaning of home and justice and love, beautifully told. And Kirkus gave it also a starred review, saying, "Buy this book." That's quite a lot of praise for a first novel. I commend you. I wonder, Joel, would you mind reading, since you, I know for School Library Journal, you had to only use, 200 words, but would you mind reading your review of Tess's book?
Well, let's check with Tess first. Is that okay, Tess?
I'm so grateful for the review. I'm grateful. It's an amazing feeling to have people connect to a story that means so much to me. It's a little piece of my heart and took me so much time to write and research. So it's a wonderful thing when people stand next to you and say, that they understand the story that's being told and the message of compassion and faith and inclining our hearts towards others. And so, yes, that'd be great.
There's that part of a writer's life that's in a closet and writing by yourself, but it's sort of like that for reviewers, too. You know, most of the time we write these reviews and send them in, and we never get any feedback. I think in the 20 years I've been reviewing for School Library Journal, I've heard from 2 or 3 authors with thanks through the years, and I remember from one author with some comments were very specifically not thanks. So I want to make sure you didn't want to throw a frying pan at me or anything.
No, I'm grateful for it. It was a wonderful review. Thank you.
Well, I should explain first in passing that when we write these reviews for School Library Journal, the purpose of the review isn't so much to entice someone to read or to make them want to dig out the book from a library. It's to librarians to try to help them decide whether or not they should buy the book for their collection. So the review is written for that very specific audience. So I have to provide some plot summary. They ask that any evaluative comments we make be integrated into the review so as to make it unnecessary to explicitly say, well, this book is recommended or it's not recommended. That should be clear from reading the review. And then if possible, they ask us to include a comparison to previously published books that have similar plots or themes. And as Steve mentioned, there's a word limit of 250 words, which means certainly can't include everything. So maybe one of the things I could ask you when we're done is whether I got the main points or whether there were things that certainly I can think of a couple things I would have liked to have included that just didn't have time. So with that introduction, here's a short review. It says, Ollie, 13, who introduces herself as the oldest of the 5 daughters of Reverend Everlasting Love, is at the center of this affecting mystery. Setting up camp in Binder, Arkansas in 1957, Ollie demonstrates sincere Christian charity and her immediate empathy for Jimmy, a boy whose mother, Virginia, is in the local jail, having confessed to murdering her husband. Everyone in Binder knows he was an evil, drunken, abusive man, But with Virginia's confession in hand, the sheriff wastes no time or energy investigating the crime, which Ollie, then her dad and mom, comes to believe Virginia could not possibly have committed. Who is Virginia protecting? Her abused, tormented son, Jimmy? A budding herpetologist who collects and cares for a garden full of frogs? The cruel local store owner, Mrs. Carter, or her sons? And what arsonist risks the loved lives, destroying their tent? Reminiscent of Frances O'Rourke Dowell's Dovey Coe in Plot, Catherine Clinton's The Calling in its portrayal of a teen whose faith is quiet, thoughtful, and completely sincere, this tug-on-your-heartstrings tale of the power of God's love is earnestly Christian, with explicitly stated but universal themes such as, even a broken life is better than no life at all. The author's use of authentic-sounding colloquialisms, Ollie gets pure and undefiled willies while speaking to the cigar-chewing sheriff, lends a sweet tea ambiance that softens some gruesome scenes and adds to the story's charm.
Well, that's a review by Joel Shoemaker for the School Library Journal of the novel For Young Adults with a Name Like Love by Tess Hilmo. Her last name is spelled H-I-L-M-O-T-E-S-S. And as I mentioned earlier, more information about Tess and her background can be found at her website. And she's also been writing a blog for a while about the production of this book. That's at TessHilmo.com. So, Tess, Joel asked you what would you have preferred to have him highlight, given those constraints that he had as a reviewer?
I think he did a great job as a review. And really, I'm truly just grateful for anyone who takes the time to read the novel. And he seems to have understood what I intended, which is my intention with the novel was to address the humanity and inhumanity of man on some level, but also to consider the fact that there are truly many amazing people in this world who will never have their names on the annals of history, but whose influence for good runs deep. And that's what I wanted to create with the Love family. I wanted to create this family that was just coming through town and really had no influence, but would change the life of this boy who is in quite a fix, and just a compassion-filled family. And, you know, what's interesting is when I started writing this novel, I had the idea of the itinerant preacher in the South, and when I sat down at the computer at the very beginning and started writing, I asked myself, who is this preacher man going to be? And for a moment, I considered having him be a bit of a louse or a philanderer to add conflict to the novel, because every novel, as you know, needs good conflict. And so I considered that. And the moment that thought entered my mind, I had this thought, and it was, that is not who I am. And I knew that I had to write this character, the father in the book, Reverend Everlasting Love, as I believe most itinerant preachers really were, not perfect men, not perfect families, but hardworking, dedicated to their families, kind, doing the best they could. And so that's what I wanted to do, and I think Joel very much understood that, you know, that this is a faith-filled family just doing the best they can, but they come upon a circumstance that's unusual for them, and they need to rise to the occasion, and they do.
And yet there is plenty of conflict in the book, and it does grab your attention, and you want to find out what's going to happen. And it's a book that's quite compelling, I think. And the reader loves being in that setting with that family, going through the struggle, and also wondering who done it. So
good.
The fact that you didn't make the main character, or the father character, another Elmer Gantry, I think worked out fine. Let me reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us later. We're talking on the phone with Tess Hilmo, the author of a novel with a name like Love, published just this last week by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Tess will be having a a launch party, her first ever, this coming up this next week, if you happen to be in what part of Utah, Tess?
It's going to be held at the American Fork Library. I'm super excited because the children's choir is going to come and sing old gospel music, including the original song that was part of the inspiration for the novel. It's going to be a great party.
This is a children's choir from where?
The American Fork Children's Choir.
Huh. Very
and
good.
The city has a children's choir, and they're going to come, and they've been practicing, and they'll be singing a few of the songs that are featured in the book.
And for those of us in a different part of the Midwest, Illinois and Indiana, we'll just have to go to your website and. But there's some things there that are a lot of fun, including an instrumental version of that song, right?
Correct, yes, there is. You can access an instrumental version of that song on my website and blog, and I'll be posting pictures of the event as well afterwards.
Or road trip, Steve. Yes, one of the subplots that I left out in the review that introduces some conflict for the characters was Ollie's desire to just stay put for a while instead of having to be itinerant.
That's right.
Tried to figure out a way to convince her father and family that it would be okay to stay in Binder. And do you want to talk a little bit about that part of the story? And
sure.
That's the main thing I felt bad about leaving out. And then the other thing was the two characters of Mrs. Mahoney and Moody, who you did wonderful things with.
I'd really love to discuss those characters. They're dear to my heart. But the first one about Ollie just wanting some roots in life. As I said, I grew up with a single mom. I grew up in California. I've been in Utah just about 10 years. And so as an adult, we moved here for my husband's work. But I grew up and got married in California. And the real estate market was really hot when I was growing up. And so my mother, as a side job, would buy and sell homes. And she kind of rode that real estate market wave to help supplement our family's income. And so we would live in the homes for a couple years, and then it was never very far, and we were quite often able to stay in the same general school district or area, but I would live in a home for about 2 years, and then we'd come home, and there'd be a for sale sign up, and all us kids would go, here we go, and we know that we were moving somewhere else, and because she would buy a home, fix it up, sell it, buy a home, fix it up, sell it, make it a little money as she went along. So it was easy for me to write that part of Ollie's journey because I remember being her age and just wanting to stay in the same place, wanting a family home that I could come back to and one that would never change. And I think that little part of me came through in this story for Ollie. She has it much worse than I did, and she longs for a stable home, and she longs for some modern conveniences. She loves her family. She just wants them to stay put for a little while at least, and she does try to convince them to stay, and something happens in that regard. I don't want to give it away, but that is her goal, is to get her family to stay and just give her some experience for a year or two at a regular school, making regular friends. And I think that came from my experience as a child a little bit of a nomadic parent, and I just wanted to stay put. And so where we are right now, I tell my children that this is their room forever. That's just because it meant so much to me. I don't think it means so much to them, but I don't have any intention of going anywhere because I really would like them to have that experience of coming back to their home as an adult and knowing that this is the home they grew up in. And it can't always be that way, but that's what I wanted as a child, and that's what Ollie wants too.
Mrs. Mahoney becomes a kind of surrogate grandmother or something.
She does. You know, Mrs. Mahoney was based on, I have a friend that just takes in people and is so good at reaching out to others, and that's a little bit who Mrs. Mahoney is based on. Mrs. Mahoney very much just comes in on their second revival, the second night of the revival, and just puts the youngest child on her lap, little Ellen, and just blends herself into that family, and in a really beautiful way that that is inspiring, I think. And I adore Mrs. Mahoney. And it's interesting because when that friend read the novel, she said, "I wish I could be like Mrs. Mahoney." And I said, "Mrs. Mahoney was based on you. That's exactly who you are." But her heart's inclined towards others, and so she's always trying to improve on that. And I think that's Mrs. Mahoney, too. And Mrs. Mahoney has some sorrow in her life that the Love family is able to help heal. And so it's a beautiful thing, I think, how they come together and they're able to help each other at this time of need in both their lives.
Let me remind listeners, if I could, that this is a live call-in show. And I realize since this book is literally just out a number of days that probably very few people in this region who are hearing this show have had a chance to hear about it and buy it and read it. But in case you have a question perhaps about the writing process that Tess Hillmo, the author, has gone through, or something else, perhaps another issue that we've raised in our conversation today, do give us a call. In the Champaign-Urbana listening area where this program originates at the University of Illinois, the number is 333-9455. That's within the 217 area code. If it's a long-distance call, and there may be listeners online as well, if you're in the continental U.S., you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. So Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Elsewhere, 800-222-WILL.
Steve, can I say, too, if it's okay, that
sure.
There is a preview of the first chapter, I believe it is, on Amazon. So if anyone's interested of at least getting a feel for the book, they can read the first chapter.
And you point out on your website at tesshillmo.com that the book is available through Amazon and through, IndieBound and Barnes & Noble. And I might say that the price is very attractive. It's a nice hardbound book, nicely put together by FSG, and yet it's very reasonably priced. Did you have any say in that, or was that totally up to the publishers?
Oh, I get no say at all. In fact, what's interesting is a new time author doesn't even get say on the cover.
Or the title.
I chose the title, but they had the chance to change it.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't change it. So I was grateful that they didn't change it. That is my original title. But the cover art is just beautiful. Matt Mahurin did the illustration, and I couldn't be more thrilled with it because I really didn't know how it would turn out. I did get a chance to see a few preliminary sketches, but I'm very pleased with what Forrestrass has done with it. They've done a beautiful job with the novel. I get no say on the pricing or how they designed the book, but I'm pleased with what they've done. They've been great to work with.
Let me ask Joel, my brother in Iowa City, who introduced me to this book. Joel, what's it like, I guess, thinking of this age group? When these authors are writing these books, so you've worked with this age group for several decades. What are some of the challenges of an author writing a book for this age group?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that audience. You mentioned young adult earlier, and that tends to be a phrase or an identifier that we use for slightly older readers, maybe grade 8 and up, age 14 and up, or something like that. And this is more a novel that's aimed at what we call the middle grades, which would be upper elementary, lower secondary. Let's say grades 5 to 8, you know, thereabouts, about age, what would that be, 10 to 13 or so.
Is that what you had in mind, Tess?
Yes, that's absolutely where the age range that I aimed it for. And it made a difference on how I crafted the book. You know, you have to be mindful of that little bit of a younger reader.
Go ahead and be a little more explicit there. So it might influence maybe the way you develop character, the kinds of language that you use, both with the young characters and the older characters. One of your considerations probably has to be, whether or not the language you use might, for example, limit sales in certain categories in schools or in certain kinds of libraries. Is that true?
Well, it can be a consideration. I really didn't worry about that on this novel. I wrote something that I would be proud of having my children read, and so the middle grade market is a good place for me because I'm not really comfortable with too much language in a book, and so it's a natural place for me to fall because I write things that I would like to read or that I would like my children to read. I would be proud to pass on to them. But it did definitely make a difference on how I plotted the murder mystery, because if you're dealing with a younger reader, then you can't have everything be on stage. You have to remove it somewhat so that it's not too upsetting or gruesome for that younger reader. And so it was a challenge for me to figure out how I was going to write a murder mystery without necessarily going into the murder too much, or how to create a character. I realized I had to create a character, and I did in Jimmy's father, Henry, where it was okay for him to be dead. And the book starts with him already being dead, and I had to create him to be such an awful man that the reader was okay with him being dead. And all of that came from my thinking about this younger reader, that it had to be okay for them. They had to understand that. And I wanted to address the issues of domestic violence, which we do in the novel, we touch on. But I had to do it in a way, again, that was amenable to this younger reader. And I had to give consideration to mostly how I plotted it and how graphic I wanted to be. And there are some dark elements to the book, but everything, when I address those, they had already happened, and they're a little bit off stage. And I think that one degree of removal makes it middle grade, whereas I think in a young adult novel or teen novel, it's okay to have those things be front and center a little bit more, if that makes any sense.
Tess, I think it'd probably be wise if the living characters that you base some of the horrible people in the book on, you don't name. I don't think you should name them.
I didn't base them on anyone. Well, I can't entirely say that. There was a news story that really upset me about something that happened in a family, and I did use a piece of that in the story. But, you know, some of our best ideas do come from real life, and then we just make them our own a little bit. But no person I actually know was any of this. Bad guys.
We're just a tad past halfway in our program today with our interview with Tess Hillmo, the first-time author of a book for middle-grade young people with a name like Love, published, came out just this last week. Also on the air is one of my brothers, Joel Shoemaker, who reviewed this book for the School Library Journal. We'll be getting back to my co-host and our guest today in just a moment, but let me take just a minute to remind people this is WILL AM 580. This program is also heard live on FM 90.9 HD3 for those of you who have those wonderful HD radios with such an additional clear signal. Also, this is broadcast online live at will.illinois.edu/AM, and it can be archived. It will be archived there at that same website if you missed part of this program or if you'd like to hear previous programs of Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual guest. I'm the usual host for these programs. Next week, we'll be talking with Reverend Bob Rasmus and Dr. Elizabeth Buckley about the Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. On October 16, I will be traveling, but Don Nolan will be interviewing Matt Sornis about a biblical perspective on immigration. That's October 16. On Sunday night, October 23rd, a guest from the Mennonite Central Committee will be talking with us, Titus Peachy, about the problems around the world of cluster bombs. Titus Peachy has spent time in Laos. He's been in other places where cluster bombs continue to be a major issue, as well as landmines. So those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. Support for this program has been provided for a number of years from the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. Friday Forum is one of the long-time lecture series at the University of Illinois, sponsored by the Y, and coming up on October 7. There'll be some people who are high school teachers in the Champaign-Urbana schools talking about how local schools are advancing social justice. That's October 7 at noon at the University Y. These lectures are free and open to the public. If you call ahead at 337-1500, you can reserve a good Thai meal. Or if you forget, you can just show up and they'll probably have enough food anyway. Or you can bring a sack lunch or simply go and listen to the free lecture. Again, that's at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street, at the corner of Wright and Chalmers, right in the heart of the campus. Easily accessible by public transportation. Probably 30 buses an hour go by there. You can get off at the university library and walk half a block to the University Y. Well, let's get back to our guest, Tess Hillmo. Tess, I've tried to be careful not to say too much about the plot of your novel, because I don't want to spoil it for people. But I think maybe what Joel started is a good thing that we could do, which is talk about some of the characters. And I want to do that as soon as we do take a first call. We have a call on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I think this is just such an interesting book. I grew up in the South. I sang all of the songs that your guest talks about. And as an adolescent, I can't think of anything more embarrassing than having a name like Olive Love. I had an aunt named Olive. Anyway, that's all I called for. Thank you.
Well,
I want to say, if you don't mind, I'd love to talk to you for just a minute, you know, about that music.
Oh, right now?
Well, I'd just like to comment on what you said, if I'm allowed to do that. Is
Please
that okay,
do.
Steve?
Please do.
Okay. I think that what you say is a really beautiful thing. You know, when I think about that Southern music and that Southern setting, there is hope and love, and it's about rising above your circumstances. And there's a lot of power in that music, and it's just something that always spoken to me. So it's a joy to hear that it's spoken to you as well. And I think that there's something very interesting about that Southern setting and that Southern music, and it's heartfelt and it's hopeful.
Yes,
and
it is.
Yes, that's what I tried to capture in this novel. But I think it speaks to a lot of people. So thank you for your comment.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Tell us the complete name of Ollie.
It's Olivine Love.
O-L-I-V-E-N-E, but yes. She goes by Ollie mostly.
She goes by Ollie. And her father's name, I chose to give him a name that, Everlasting Love, because he was born to be a preacher, and I had to choose a name that really he had no other choice. He came from a long line of preachers, itinerant preachers, and that's just who he was. It was in his blood. It was everything he was and everything he ever wanted to be. But the girls I was careful to give regular names to, and I say in the book that's because their mother has a little mercy and gave them regular names. They still had the family name of Love, but Ollie is Olivine. The other sisters are a little more common names, but Olivine, as I said, came from family history on my father's side. When I was looking through those records, I came across that name, and it just spoke to me, and I thought, Ollie, that's who the character is. So
now, you've spoken about hope and love, but there's also, and one of the things that I mentioned earlier I really appreciated, was the fact that early on you show these sisters squabbling and being jealous of one another, and they're pretty close together, 11 months apart, the first two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're fussing with one another, and mm-hmm. I think that adds such a realistic touch and a real insight into family relations.
Yeah, I think that with this family, nothing is perfect, and in anyone's family. And so I did want to portray the different personalities. Within any family, there are different personalities. And I wanted to give each of those five girls their own specific and true personality. And some of those get along better than others, just like in any family. But in the end, they lean upon each other and they come together. But it was kind of fun to write that relationship, those relationships I think you're talking about. There's a special relationship specifically between Ollie, who's the oldest, and then the next one down, Martha, is just 11 months younger. And they struggle because they're so close. And in fact, I said to my own child, my very oldest, I have one who's 17, and then I have a 12-year-old. There's a five-year gap. And then the third one is right behind the 12-year-old. And I said to my oldest, 5 years is a lot easier than 2 years apart. The 2 years, they squabble constantly. And so I'd seen it in my own life, and it was kind of fun to write that the little bit of conflict that they had with each other, but they do work through it. And then I also loved writing about Ellen, the very youngest child, and her relationship with Ollie, Ollie being the oldest, and how Ollie looks out for Ellen, and Ellen just looks up and adores Ollie. And but that sibling relationship was really, really rewarding and fun to write. It was challenging because with five different girls and then their parents, it's kind of a large cast of characters, and it was challenging to make them all very individual and distinct, but it was fun to do.
Now, with
Let's
the book
talk
written,
about another character for a second, too. Sufficient time has passed that this novel could legitimately be called historical fiction.
It is called historical fiction.
Being set in 1957. And
how does that make you feel, Joel?
Oh, really old. But I'm interested in your little subtext there about about racism. They introduce an African American character named Moody, just Moody. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit about your inclusion of him as a character, or about what you might hope to accomplish by bringing him into the story in terms of communicating something about change in our country.
Well, yeah, I'd be happy to discuss that. You know, when I was writing this story, it's 1957 in the South, and we all know that that was a really difficult time in the South and that there was a lot going on. And what I didn't want to do was have this become a story about the race struggles and relations that were going on at that time. And so I was very careful to keep it. I tried to create this town almost a world of its own. And I think a lot of small towns in the South at that time, they were kind of worlds unto them own. They're disconnected. They had their own rules. They had their own politics within the town, and that's what I tried to focus on, because I didn't want to distract too much from the story, which to me the story is about the family and about Jimmy and about the mystery element. And so I tried not to make it too much about that struggle, but it would be unrealistic to write a story in the South and not have some element of race in it. And so I introduced Moody, and he came to me as a character kind of in pieces. He watches over Jimmy. And so you have this little boy. I don't think it gives anything away from the story to say that his mother is in jail for murdering his father, so he's all alone, and he lives by himself up the holler. But Moody lives just down the way a little bit, and he looks over Jimmy. But because he is of color, because he's an African American, the town won't listen to him. And he wants to help Jimmy, but he really can't, because he has no pull in this town. And at one point, Ollie invites him to come down to the revival, and he doesn't go because he knows, or he feels, he's not welcome. But he is a respite for this little boy who has nothing, and he is a soft place to fall, and it's someone to lean upon. And so he was a great character to write, because he was so loving, and maybe a little misunderstood in this town, and I love that I wrote him singing my song, that he's this faith-filled man who is just, you know, one day at a time working and doing the best he can. And
I thought that was a very gentle evocation of that element. Enjoyed it a lot. Like I say, sorry I couldn't get it in the review. And then another minor part, I'm noticing on your blogspot here at testhelmo.blogspot.com, there's a photo of you cringing just a bit as you hold the frog. Can you talk a little bit about your inclusion of the frog element, the herpetology interest for Jimmy? Where did that come from?
Okay, so when we moved to Utah about 10 years ago, again, growing up in California, I didn't have a lot of wildlife around me. And when we moved here, I loved having just a little bit of land. Everyone where we are is on about an acre. And the storms here are just beautiful. We get a lot of rain. We're right up against the mountains. And the first summer we moved here, we had a beautiful summer storm, and frogs came out everywhere. And children from down the street came knocking on our door. Now, first of all, it was just very unusual for me to have neighbor children who I didn't know knocking on my door. It's nothing that I was used to coming from the cities. And so these sweet little children came knocking on the door and said, "Can we look in your window wells and catch the toads and the frogs?" And I said, "If I can join you." And so we went out and we started collecting frogs. And it was just a really fun thing for my children to be able to do, something I saw within my neighborhood. And so when I decided to include the element of frogs, I did it for two reasons. One, because I thought it was something that seemed like Jimmy would do. It needed to be a hobby that a boy would enjoy, and so that seemed natural to me. And two, because of the abuse that happens to Jimmy, I didn't really want to have happen to Jimmy. And so I thought if I included the frogs, then that would be something that I'm trying not to give too much of the story away here, but
right.
Something that where the father is unkind to the son through his pets. And I couldn't do that with a dog or a cat because they're a little too close to people, I think. And so by having it be a reptile, then, you know, or an amphibian, then that just seemed enough removed that it would be okay to have happen what happens in the novel. But I'll tell you, I had the greatest time researching frogs. It was a lot of work to learn all about them, and for Jimmy to be able to have it be really his only friends. The frogs and Moody are the only friends that he has, and he had to know everything about frogs. And so to write it, I had to learn everything about frogs, and it was the funnest thing to do. I had pictures all over my office wall of all the different frogs and all the facts about them, and it was just a really fun time in the novel when I was learning about that. But
good.
I wrote them as his friends, and they are. They're like his little children are his friends.
Before we run out of time, I should say, though, that it seemed to me that you focused like a laser and everything about the book on the idea of love being the central part of the story, from the title to the characters' names to the plot and structure and how the family deals with everything. And that was, you know, that's redeeming. I like seeing you agree with my friends John Lennon and Paul McCartney,
yes.
You know.
All we need is love. Well, that we need to incline our hearts towards others. I think that this family is a family filled with compassion, but more than that, they're motivated to relieve the suffering of this little boy. They're motivated to help others, and that is very much, as I was writing it, on my mind and my intention, you know, is that we can make the difference. We can be an influence for good in the lives of others, and that through love and acceptance that great things can happen.
I thought it was interesting, as you dealt with these religious people who are, itinerant evangelists, and yet your book did not take the tone of trying to evangelize in any way. I thought it was very interesting that you are completely sort of non-sectarian. You're not sort of pushing one Christian denomination. In fact, people of other faiths would find this book, I think, perfectly acceptable for their children to read or for them to read, because the way you handle the religious theme is not where you're trying to convert somebody or you're trying to change somebody. You're trying to rather, I think, would it be fair to say, inspire them?
Yes. Well, I wanted to thank you for saying that because I worked very hard on that, actually, and that was very much on my heart that I did not, the story is not about faith. The story is not about religion. The story is about a religious family, and I just wanted to give a bird's-eye view into the life of an itinerant family. And so you have this itinerant family set in the South. There are going to be elements of faith to the book, but I was very careful to keep it tied to each individual character.
And we never hear a sermon from the preacher, for example. And
no Bible quotes.
No quotes, yeah, right.
No, because that's not what the story is about. But right. It's about Ollie and her struggle with her family and her love for her family and trying to help this boy who's in trouble. And it's about Reverend Love, who has this quiet strength and is this kind of gentle giant, and the good father that he is to his family, him just doing his best. The story is not, I never wrote a story about faith, but I did write a story about a family who embraces their faith. And so I tried very much to show the life of an itinerant preacher because that intrigued me, and I thought it would be interesting for children today. They don't know much about that, but I made a great effort to keep the faith as it relates to each individual character, as it relates to each individual character.
Let's talk a little bit. Sense. Yeah, I do understand that. Let's talk a little bit about a book that's written for 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds, mm-hmm. being read by people who are much older, like myself, who yet still enjoyed it. How do you do that?
Well, there are a few books that really inspire me. I find that I end up reading a lot of middle grade fiction, and when I give them to my friends, I don't tell them it's middle grade fiction, and they enjoy it. And there are a few, for example, The Witch of Blackbird Pond. That's one of my early favorites as a child. And I remember reading that, and I remember my mother reading it, and we both loved it. And that's the beauty of middle grade fiction. I think that it can be enjoyed by parents, grandparents, teachers, librarians, and children if it's done in such a way that, you know, with that goal. And that's what I really tried to do. And so I'm thrilled to hear that you think it achieved that. But there are a few books out there. The Witch of Blackbird Pond is one, but also Lizzie Bright and the Buckminster Boy by Gary Schmidt. I gave that book to a friend of mine and just didn't tell her it was middle grade fiction. She came back and said, "How come I haven't heard of this book? It's such a fantastic book." But I said, because it's really a children's book, but Gary Schmidt writes it so well that it appeals to all readers. So I think middle grade fiction can.
As a librarian and a person who's read books for teenagers for a number of years, my stock answer is always a good book is a good book is a good book.
Thank you, Joel. I think that's well said.
We're talking about a novel written for the middle grades, age 10 through 13, but which is a good book, and I'm happy to recommend it. It's written by Tess Hilmo, H-I-L-M-O. You can learn more about her, and you can find ways to purchase the book by going to tesshilmo.com, T-E-S-S-H-I-L-M-O. With a Name Like Love, published just this week by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, and available now.
What else have you got in the works, Tess? Are there some of those other three that were in the drawer going to come out?
No, those are truly practice novels. The first one that I wrote, you know, writing is an interesting thing. You don't know that you can write a novel. I wanted to, but I had no idea that I could actually do it. And so the first novel I wrote, as soon as I finished it, I knew that it went in the drawer. And it was just learning about how to characterize, how to do a story arc. And I made a lot of mistakes in that novel, but I learned from those mistakes. And then the next novel I felt was a little bit stronger. And hopefully, as I continue to write, I'll just keep learning from my mistakes and growing. And like with any craft, just getting better. So I'm really not looking backwards. I am looking forward. I am working on a new novel. It's also middle grade. But instead of a Southern flair, it has a little bit of a cowboy Western flair, which has been really fun for me. Living Out West. It's not historical, it's contemporary, and it's about family and about identity, figuring out who we really are and how our family can our genealogy and our history can help us better appreciate who we are. So it's been fun to write, but I'm still in the middle of it.
When did you finish with A Name Like Love?
Well, that's interesting. I finished it about 3 years ago. It actually sold to FSG 2 years ago, and it takes them about 2 years to go through the editing process, go through the design process, send out their review copies, and then finally to do the print run. It was almost 2 years from the time it sold. And I wrote it, I finished about a year before that. So, and the novel itself took me about 5 months to write on the first draft, and then I revised for about a year, and then it sold.
You mentioned resources on your website for other beginning writers, other writers. What did you find most helpful yourself?
Well, the children's literature community is amazingly supportive, and it's been a real blessing on this journey. And so there are different resources. They're listed on my website. The main one is the Society of Children Book Writers and Illustrators, and that's found at scbwi.org. They have conferences both nationally and on a local level in every area across the world, in fact. And they were a wonderful resource. I went to my first SCBWI conference in Los Angeles 9 years ago, not having any idea how to write a book, just a desire in my heart to do it. And they taught me everything, really, all about characterization, all about plotting, all about marketing, all about how to find an agent, every step along the way. They're really a fantastic resource. And also where I found my critique group through them, which is huge if you can get a critique group. But going to those conferences, I met other people and formed a critique group, and that was helpful as well.
We're going to have to stop with that recommendation. I want to thank my brother Joel Shoemaker from Iowa City, who writes reviews for, among other places, School Library Journal.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Again, this novel has been highly praised in reviews. Kirkus, for example, gave it a starred review, and it was an American Booksellers Association New Voices selection for 2011. We're talking about With a Name Like Love by Tess Hilmo, H-I-L-M-O. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Next week, we'll be talking with Reverend Bob Rasmus and Dr. Elizabeth Buckley about Lutheran social services throughout Illinois. On October 16, I'll be traveling, but Don Nolan will be our guest host, and he'll be talking about a biblical perspective on immigration. That's Matt Sornes. On October 23rd, the topic will be cluster bombs. I'll be back, and we'll be interviewing Titus Peachy from the Mennonite Central Committee about the danger of cluster bombs around the world. Again, at Friday Forum here at the University of Illinois this coming Friday, How Local Schools Are Advancing Social Justice, with several high school teachers from the Champaign-Urbana community. The following week, Harriet Marav will be talking about unionization, what's better for education. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, Rethinking Animal Intelligence, Maybe How Memory Works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.